Hello there, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. It's our usual Friday wrap, and I'm joined today by Pat Leahy and Jack Horgan-Jones. But before we do start, one last reminder that next week we're going to be taking an in-depth look at North and South, the collaboration between the Irish Times and Aaron's Analysing and Researching Ireland, North and South. We're still very keen to put your questions to the project coordinators, so please do send them to politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. That's politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. And do try and get them in the next 24 hours or so by Saturday, February the 4th. And if possible, do send them as an audio file, because we do like that. But anyway, to the matters of the day. Hi, Jack and Pat.
Hello, Hugh.
Hi, Hugh and Pat.
I'm looking forward to the bank holiday weekend, of course, but it was a busy week. Jack, so much going on, really, but maybe this story which blew up on foot of a newspaper story last weekend about the nursing home charges and the policy of successive governments in resisting attempts to make them pay for private nursing home care for public patients, essentially.
Yes, so the Mail on Sunday had this story based on a cache of documents they got from the now famous or infamous, depending on your perspective, Department of Health whistleblower Shane Corr, previously seen in RTE and the Business Post, who have done exposés based on material that he has brought to light. This particular one focuses on a legal strategy that the state developed and deployed in reaction to the legal risk, I suppose, of being taken through the courts by people or the families of people who had medical cards, but ended up in private nursing homes and ended up having to fund private nursing home care. The state's position is that it has no legal obligation to these people, but the difficulty they face is the nature of the defence that they constructed never actually sought to have that tested in the courts. And it seems that as and when cases were taken to the point of discovery, which is where document exchange occurs and usually is one of the last stages before actually going to court, or certainly in the latter half of the kind of pre-court exchange of information, they would settle at that point. So the allegation, I suppose, in the first hand from the opposition is that these people were illegally charged, which is something that the government strongly rejects. And indeed, one of the more interesting parts of this week's exchanges was a blanket defence of what the government and what effectively previous governments have done by the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar and all this week, who effectively said it was a good strategy and I do it again in the morning. And then the other charge, I suppose, that they're facing is that they have acted as an overly aggressive defendant when being taken to task by a plaintiff who most people would have a good degree of sympathy with, that is, you know, people who are in the lower deciles of income, as evidenced by the fact that they have a medical card, and are obviously in at a vulnerable life stage, as evidenced by the fact that they need nursing home care, which is quite often end of life care in Ireland. So I think there's two problems that the government face here. On the one hand, you know, they're whether or not the legal justification they have for their actions holds water throughout, that will be tested in the first instance by a report that's being drawn up by the Attorney General, Rossa Fanning, which will be brought to Cabinet next week and published thereafter. I suspect he will say, and in fact my understanding is he has already given a strong backing at Cabinet last week, albeit an informal one, to the strategy so far. So, you know, they will, I suspect, get a pass from him. And then, you know, the question is whether that is ever tested again in the future, whether a case comes to court, whether that kind of legal aspect is ever challenged, and whether that edifice is maintained. The second and more kind of volatile one, I suppose, is the political angle, and whether these charges that the government has acted in an indifferent or overly aggressive way to those vulnerable plaintiffs is one that sticks, and how that kind of spins out over the next while, because I think we'll be ready to see a whole host of people being trooped through the Oireachtas Health Committee following this, and you know, people will be really getting down into the detail on this, and the risk, as always, and I think that there's quite a lot of nervous politicians around, because a lot of people have inhabited the Department of Health or the senior offices of government who would, it would seem, have signed off in some way, shape or form on this strategy since it came into incarnation some point prior to 2011. So that's the other test of this. It goes in two directions: one, the legal, and second, the political. And they are nervous about the political, because I think in some ways there's almost echoes of the cervical check controversy here, that it could kind of metastasize to something of that level. That's certainly the fear.
So, yeah, the legal side of this, Pat, seems relatively straightforward. It may well be that if the state was trying for many years to avoid discovery of documents so that other people wouldn't successfully be able to take their cases to court, this will clarify this once and for all now. It's fully out in the open and we'll find out, you know, what happened and what might happen into the future, which might incur very significant costs for the state in the not-too-distant future. The political and ethical one seems to me to be more confusing. It is, again, as Jack says, reminiscent of recurring scandals of the past where the state treated in a miserly or meagre or cruel, arguably, way, particularly people who were relatively weak. And I do wonder about that. I do find the Varadkar defence interesting. You know, he raises that question, which is, I'm sure we'll get a lot of people's backup, but it seems to me to be a legitimate question, which is, should the children of tomorrow pay for the sins of their parents and their grandparents in this regard and be saddled with huge debts? I mean, is that something that you can actually consider at all, or is that just outside the pale in terms of considering?
Well, it's the sort of longer term and philosophical consideration, Hugh, that we're very well used to on this podcast, but rarely feature in the decision-making process in government, in my experience, where the imperative is to avoid the political shitstorm that may be coming down the tracks in the coming days. I suppose on the question of the state's approach that you raise there is, as ever, there's conflicting imperatives for the government. Of course, any government has finite financial resources and has a responsibility, a broader responsibility, to safeguard, you know, the financial stability of the country. And it's worth noting that, you know, hundreds of millions or billions that are paid out in compensation are then hundreds of millions or billions that are not expended in the provision of services. At the same time, you know, this isn't the first time that we have seen this sort of, to some perspectives, uncaring or callous or maybe just short-sighted approach from the short-sighted and overly legalistic approach from the state in the face of claims which many people might view as justified and which certainly the protagonists view as a matter of basic fairness. And I think, you know, Conor O'Mahony, he's a UCC legal academic and recently retired as the government's special rapporteur on child protection, made the point in a few Twitter posts during the week that I was quoting in an analysis piece, that this is routinely how the state operates when it is faced by litigation from people who have rights under law or who believe they have rights under law. The state doesn't either front up a defence or it doesn't immediately cave and provide the services or the compensation that is sought. It wears them out, or it seeks to wear them out, through a long and drawn out defence, and then eventually settles with those litigants who have been either well resourced enough or determined enough, and in some cases both, to see the process to its conclusion. And I do think that there is something kind of from an equity point of view that is unsatisfactory about that. Same time, I guess, if I am Minister for Health, I'm thinking I don't want my budgets busted by a series of claims for compensation. So I think there's claims that are justifiably competing here.
But it's a system that favours the powerful and the well-resourced over the weak and the less well-resourced, isn't it? And people will then point to other situations in which companies, banks, other sorts of institutions have received redress from the state, and, you know, and they will draw their, you know, quite justified parallels.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess nobody receives redress from the state without a pretty determined effort. And often the redress that is then, you know, granted is granted after such a long period of time that, you know, it's unsatisfactory from almost all perspectives. It's unsatisfactory from the point of view of current taxpayers to be saddled with a bill for, you know, historic inefficiencies or neglect by the state. But it's also unsatisfactory from the people who get at the end of the day. I'm not sure what the answer is, Hugh, but your observation is certainly true, that it's a system that doesn't favour, you know, people without resources or without other capacities to pursue a fight against the state over a long period of time.
Another phenomenon which may be an example of another way in which this plays out in Irish society is something that's really on the top of the news agenda now, Jack, and which you're going to be writing about this weekend, which is the increasing level of protests against the housing of migrants and asylum seekers in particular, all over the country really at this point, in various places in Dublin and in provincial towns around the country. You were out at one of these protests this week?
Yes, I was. I went to Finglas Garda Station on Wednesday night, where there was kind of one of the biggest protests of this nature that has taken place so far. I was with our colleague Conor Lally, who was there, and he covered about four or five of these, and he said it was certainly the biggest one. And it was also the biggest policing reaction to it. One of the most striking things about it was for a crowd of maybe 250 people, which never, to my mind, seemed like it was going to turn violent, there was an overwhelming visible police force and also some specialist units held in reserve. So you had 12 uniformed officers at one end of the road, four Garda cars with the blue lights on. At the other end of the road, you had more Garda cars. In between, you had four vans with the public order unit in it. I saw in behind the back of the station, it's a large station with a kind of courtyard and enclosed area behind it. And I saw in that courtyard, there were kitted up members of the public order unit as well, ready to go if anything happened. And also there was an armed support unit vehicle a little bit further down the road. So it was to some extent, well, not a kind of, you know, they weren't cracking skulls, but like they were, I felt, and the presence of the Garda helicopter overhead as well, I think validated that this was a bit of a show of force of what the Garda can muster, which is interesting because talking to security sources during the week, they were saying one of the challenges the guards have faced in this has been the fact that these things are popping up like mushrooms and they're a real draw on resources. And so while they don't think that any of them are necessarily going to turn violent, just from a public order point of view or just from a traffic management point of view or whatever, it takes a lot of Garda resources to manage them. Now, that's the Garda policing part of it kind of looked after. What I thought was really interesting was the kind of inchoate and messy nature of what was being articulated. So you had speakers talking about everything from, you know, some of the kind of bogus, quasi-legalistic ideologies, Freeman on the Land stuff that we saw during the financial crisis, talking about the illegitimacy of the courts and, you know, how you could assert your rights to receive a statute in the old Irish from a Garda or else they couldn't do X, Y, or Z. And these were some of the ideologies being espoused. And then from within the crowd itself, a frustration growing about this, and at one point someone said, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, you know, we're not interested in that shite, you know, we're here for the immigrants. And that was said several times. And what I thought was notable was that the sentiments that provoked the kind of loudest and most uniformly positive or encouraging response from the crowd were those anti-immigration sentiments. And talking to people within government and around government over the course of reporting this piece that's going in tomorrow, there is a definite concern growing about the scale of this. They don't think it's on the scale of the water charges protest, but on the other hand, they do point out that while the water charges protest was very much anti-government, there's a wider sense of alienation and anger towards the system writ large. And that's something that I saw in the piece or at the protest as well on Wednesday evening, when curiously, there was much more targeted abuse and slagging off of Sinn Féin than there was at the government. You know, like there were people up there talking about how Sinn Féin wanted to, you know, work towards a united Ireland under the Crown. What exactly that means, I don't know. But like, it was just interesting that that was a thread that is being picked at. And I think that's one of the overriding concerns, that there's just this massive inchoate kind of, but very volatile anger building up there. And that there are, and this is the assessment of the security forces as well, that there are far right elements within that who are well positioned to manipulate and exploit that. And I think that you saw that in the fact that the most coherent reaction from the crowd was when someone said something that had an anti-immigration stance running all the way through it. And then playing out against that, again, we have a lot of detail that I won't bore you with now in the piece tomorrow about...
You can bore us with it tomorrow, Jack.
I'll bore you on a Saturday. I've already bored you on a Friday. About just the level of pressure that exists to accommodate all these people as they come in. And we saw that with the front page story that Pat and myself had today, with yet another desperate plea for vacant buildings emanating from Roderick O'Gorman, who now effectively seems to be at panic stations, you know, saying, you know, what have you got? Give it to us. We'll put mattresses in there. We'll put sleeping beds in there, because they really are at a massive pinch point, which they claim is at its most acute for the next couple of months. But again, when you look at the longer term projections, they're all the way out to December, and we have the details on them tomorrow, and they're pretty grim. I don't know exactly what solution there is available to them, but they really need to find one.
Yeah, today's story, Pat, that, you know, talks about community centres, art centres, anything that's available at all that has four walls and a roof, as far as I can see. Roderick O'Gorman is looking for it.
Yeah, and I mean, he's looking for vacant buildings, obviously, but I'm not sure how many, you know, vacant sports centres or arts venues or conference centres, etc., there are out there. And, you know, I mean, Jack noted that there's a real air of desperation, I thought, about this letter, which has gone to other ministers who will pass it on to their, pass it on to their officials, who will pass it down the line to various sorts of organisations that are under the ambit of each government department. But, you know, without officials actually going out and, you know, looking for such venues, you know, it's hard to see many of them being discovered. And, you know, I think we're really in for, a tough few months on this front, or rather the refugees themselves are in for a tough few months on this front, because as you've both noted, there will be nowhere to put them when they come here. And I think we reached the stage now where, okay, we're saying there's nowhere to put them, and we need to roll up sleeping bags in halls. So they've got to find those halls now, and this is what it's about. So, and I think you're going into, the officials would say, yes, the next few months is going to be difficult, but then we hope to have more temporary accommodation coming on stream, modular homes and so forth. But all the while, people are arriving. This is it's a moving, not a static target. And I think there is a hope in official circles. I'm not sure I would elevate it to the level of a strategy, but there is a hope in official circles that if the situation is very bad here, that people will stop coming, that the numbers of people that are coming will begin to tail off, and that will then enable the target to stop moving and enable officials to get to grips, and the system to get to grips with the numbers that are there at the moment, which, you know, if you think about it, it's not a brilliant approach, really, you know.
No, it is not. Jack, one last question to you on this. I mean, I know you say these things are popping up all over the country, these protests, and this may be my bad judgment call here, but If this was one of the biggest ones and it was 250 people, it's not that many people by the standard of, you know, demonstrations on other issues that we've seen in the past. Is there any possibility at all that we're overstating the level of hostility that's out there right now?
It's a good question. So I think we need to draw a distinction between identifying this as a mass movement of the scale of the most recent example is the water charges, and then the tax stuff that happened in the late 80s. Fairly imprecise description there. I'll defer to some of my senior colleagues to be more precise as to what the tax stuff that happened in the late 80s was.
You refer, of course, to the PAYE protests, don't you?
That's it. Thank you very much.
In the early 1980s, Jack, before you were born.
Thank you. Well, there you go. You've offered my excuse for me. So we need to draw a distinction between that and what we're seeing right now. I think that the difference is just it's the frequency of these things. It's the fact that they're so widespread. And talking to people, TDs, who keep tabs on the emergence of these protests in their constituencies, they're saying that notwithstanding the kind of niche and to an extent comforting explanation that this is the product of manipulation by a kind of sinister fringe or the far right or whatever, which there is elements of truth too. They are seeing, you know, quote unquote, ordinary people in there, mainstream people. They feel this is going mainstream and that it is, that there is an audience out there, you know, that is at a bare minimum curious about what is happening. And that the both the kind of on the ground outworkings of that, be that whether a couple of lads leave a protest like this all amped up and beat someone up, or, you know, the more substantial political outworkings of this, whether this kind of sentiment is ever given a voice, a parliamentary outworking, I don't know. You know, the radical fringes of kind of most forms of politics have generally not enjoyed that widespread of parliamentary representation in the Dáil. But could that be something that emerges over the next period? I don't know. Or is it just something that moves migration politics more to the centre of mainstream politics? And I think that's where we're going to lie. That's you know, I was talking to someone in cabinet earlier on today, and they were saying this in the round, not necessarily, you know, the migration crisis or the accommodation crisis that is associated with it, but your migration policies are now going to be something you're asked about on the doorstep, which is something that has not really happened, I suspect, in about 20 years, if it ever happened at all. And that's where I think, you know, that's why I think this is important, both on the ground, the policing threat, the lack of social cohesion, and the threat to vulnerable people that may arise from it, and also how it kind of moves the centre ground of Irish politics and how it changes the issues that people care about and have salience for voters.
One other thing that's bubbling away in the background, Pat, it's somewhat more esoteric, it feels, in comparison to what Jack's been talking about there, is the prospect of a deal on the Northern Ireland Protocol. And anything happened this week, or is it just all rumours and whispers?
Just to add very briefly to what Jack said there, to conclude on that subject, is, you know, this is something that we've seen, you know, on immigration happening all over Europe. We would be naive to think, you know, that there isn't a constituency that wants to limit very severely immigration into Ireland here. And I think what we're in danger of now is that, you know, failures of government to react to the situation with sufficient foresight and then scale and capacity will lead to an anti-immigration theme becoming part of our politics. And I think that's what that cabinet member was referring to. And I think we're pretty close now to that particular genie being left out of the box, if it hasn't already got out. And, you know, the kind of comforting myths that we've taught ourselves in the past about the Irish being, you know, singularly immune to racism, and this kind of rather witless, you know, idea that, oh, you know, if you're a racist, then you're not an Irish person. I think we're about to be confronted with the shortcomings in those particular analyses of the situation. On the protocol, talks are continuing. There was a story in the London Times during the week which said a deal had been done between the EU and the UK. That was immediately greeted with a flurry of denials in London and in Brussels and in Dublin. My sense of it is that that a deal is very close, that many of the obstacles to a deal have been overcome, on the one hand by the EU's willingness to see checks on goods coming from Great Britain to Northern Ireland almost disappear in a practical sense, not disappear altogether. This idea, you know, that there will be an utterly seamless customs border between Great Britain and Northern Ireland is not going to happen, because Northern Ireland will be subject to some single market rules under the protocol. The protocol is not going to be torn up. I don't think it's even going to be rewritten or tweaked. Its application will be, and how it is enforced will be tweaked quite significantly. On the other hand, it seems that the British demands on the European Court of Justice and so forth are likely to fall away.
Sorry, Pat, can I just ask you that second point, the one about the European Court of Justice?
Yes.
We are told that is, you know, led to believe that that's the thing that might actually spark a serious rebellion, for example, in the Tory party among the European Research Group or whatever, because these core principles, as they see them, of sovereignty regained can't be impugned by something like that.
Yeah, and this is the question that I have about it, and again, I'll be writing in tomorrow's paper about this. I'm not sure that Sunak, Rishi Sunak, is strong enough in his own party to force through a deal that will, like all compromises, not give lots of people absolutely everything that they want. And there is I think there's something of an optimism bias amongst many people involved in this, that, you know, because all sides want a deal, they think that a deal will be done. And I think we will find out a lot about Sunak's strength within his own party in the coming weeks, because if he is going to conclude a deal, then he will do so, you know, over the objections of the ERG. And what happens to him then, and what happens in that process of gaining the assent of his own party on it, that's before we get to the DUP at all, then I think that is pretty uncertain at the moment. So while there's a lot of optimism around about a deal being done, I have some questions about what happens then.
Before we wrap things up, Jack, we each make a choice of what we thought was a particularly striking story of the week in the Irish Times. What's your one?
So our colleague Cliff Taylor wrote a good piece this week about the post-COVID reshaping of the city centre, which is something I find very interesting. I walk across Dublin City twice a day on my way to Leinster House and back to the north side. And Cliff has kind of parsed over, you know, the changing streetscape that he sees around him, and you know, how retailers are changing and how the city centre is or isn't changing, and the good or the bad or the indifferent changes that have followed on from the pandemic, which is something that I tend to think a little bit about just on my strolls around the place as well. You know,
what's your perception? I see a place in decline. What do you think?
I agree to an extent. Like, I see a place that is kind of has a bit of an identity crisis, or at least a crisis of proper strategic planning. You know, like Dublin City Centre feels to me like it's just terminally less than the sum of its parts. You know, there's good parts to it, but none of it seems to fit together as a whole. And there's these kind of gaping problems that have never been addressed. I grew up in the north of the city until I was about 15, and you know, the chronic problems in and around where I spent my formative years on Garden Street and Mountjoy Square are fundamentally unchanged from the late 1970s when my parents bought a house there. You know, it's deprivation that was made worse by the tide of the heroin epidemic in the 80s, and now seems to be kind of entrenched. And so, sorry, that's the wax lyrical about Cliff's piece. I mean, the reason I really liked Cliff's piece is because it strikes me that he literally just stood up on the third floor of Tara Street at the Irish Times building with his notepad and wrote down what he saw and cracked a column out of it, which the Irish Times is often criticised for only reporting what happens in Dublin within the canals or perhaps within the M50. But he literally just wrote down what he saw.
Yeah, I think I've generated at least three columns about the kind of massive building site, actually, which exists across the street from the Irish Times at the moment. So it can always prompt a couple of ideas if you're, you know, if you're feeling a bit short. But
well, I have a slight confession to make, that I was, you know, reading some of the reports of what was happening in London during the week, and I wrote a highly abusive and I think entertaining paragraph about the European Research Group in the Tory party. And then to preserve that, I just constructed a column around that. So readers can judge, I suppose, tomorrow what they think of that.
Okay, marks out of 10 for our readers. Before I ask you what your article is, I'm just going to briefly say my one. Also rooted on the third floor of the Irish Times in the features department, which, as some people will know, is a repository for decaying, aged journalists. We're sort of the Miss Havishams of the Irish Times, you know, scratching away with quills and vellum there on the arts. But we do have one younger member of staff who had been away for a while, and he came back. His name is Conor Coplis, and he came back with a mullet haircut and a little fuzzy moustache as well, and he's written an article about the reaction to that. I'm actually quoted there, but if not by name, because He looks very like, to me, very like the famous West German footballer, Rudi Völler, who won the World Cup in 1990. Although some people made less kinder comparisons. I think German porn star was mentioned, member of the Stasi. A lot of German stuff going on there anyway. Anyway, I think it's great.
Big Teutonic vibes, yeah.
For somewhere like the very aged features department to have a young person who has actually figured out a way to horrify older people, which Connor has successfully managed to do. It's a very entertaining piece. Pat.
Well, in a similarly weighty fashion, I don't pick one individual article. I pick the entire week's coverage of the Six Nations, which is starting tomorrow, as our listeners will know. And I've been reading all of our stuff by Jerry Thornley and his colleagues very closely. It's one of my favourite times of year. I like the Six Nations almost as much as I like the Munster Hurling Championship. It starts tomorrow, so don't call me for the next few weeks.
Grat, I like the Six Nations more than I like the Munster Hurling Championship, so I'm just as happy, if not happier, than you. In fact, I've got a snide aside about Munster in my column tomorrow, but you'll have to go to the Irish Times to read it. And of course, don't forget that in order to do that from a digital point of view anyway, it's a good idea to sign up to subscribe to the Irish Times at irishtimes.com/subscribe. We will leave it there for the week, thanks to Pat and to Jack, to our producer Declan Conlon and our engineer JJ Vernon. We're going to be back very soon. It is a bank holiday, so do enjoy it. See you after that. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taken to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.